This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 26th of January 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, I'll discuss the day's top news stories with Mary Dzhajewski and Roger Boys. The office of the UN Special Envoy sends out invitations for Syria peace talks due to take place later this week in Geneva. And it's still not known who will attend. The Danish Parliament passes measures to deter refugees from seeking asylum, including confiscating their valuables. Also, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says it's high time for the West to drop its policy of containing Russia. And in Rome, classic nude sculptures are covered, seeming to avoid offending the Muslim president of Iran. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, as you heard, my guest today, Mary Dzhajewski, a columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, and Roger Boys, the diplomatic editor of The Times here in London. Welcome both to the programme. The office of the UN Special Envoy for Syria says it's today sent out invitations for peace talks, which are due to take place on Friday in Geneva, though it won't specify to whom. The Syrian opposition has cast doubt on whether it would go to Geneva, accusing the United States of adopting unacceptable Iranian and Russian ideas for solving the conflict. Roger, who do we think will be going and who won't be going?
Well, we know who won't go. That's the Islamic State and al-Nusra, and the al-Nusra Front, which is aligned to al-Qaeda. So they definitely haven't got invitations. There are a lot of other groupings which are quite close to those kind of ideas. There's the Islamic Front, which wants an Islamic State. Seems to be invited. The key meeting was last December with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, as part of the what's called the Vienna process, agreed to create a united platform of opposition groups that would then attend this meeting. But this has been, ever since that happened, there's been kind of systematic sabotaging going on. So, for example, the Russians on December 25th bombed and killed four commanders of one of the Saudi-backed groups, who's also the son of a Saudi cleric. So he's not going. There are others too that are being sort of manipulated out. And the other dodgy element is the Kurds. The radical Kurds, if you'd like to put it that way, the YPG, have been to Moscow, and Moscow supports very much the idea of the Kurds being at the conference. The Turks are adamantly against it, which is probably why the Russians want them to be invited in the first place, so as to split Turkey and the rest of the NATO members in these talks. So there we are. I don't know if that's clarified.
Well, kind of, just two things, Roger. We know that that there's been a cessation of diplomatic ties between the Saudis and the Iranians. Now, does that mean that they each will not come to and face each other at the negotiating table for Syria, or will they actually oddly put that behind them and both pitch up, do you think?
I think they'll be there, but at a low level. I think the Saudis have got too much invested in these talks not to go. And Iran is busy on a kind of love me kind of tour at the moment, will listen to any American persuasion.
And lastly, the notion of the all these terms are so difficult, but the moderate opposition in Syria, who are armed, are fighting, but the Assad government has said they will never negotiate with, and likewise, they've mainly said they don't want to be associated with any negotiations with Assad. Does it seem that some of those groups backed by the US may be represented?
But these are, as you've rightly guessed, there are multiple feuds going on. There's Assad versus moderate rebels. There are people excluded. There's Turkey versus Russia. There's Saudi Arabia versus Iran. And then there are multiple internal rows. And that's why the list is being kept secret by De Mistura. By Friday, it should be a little bit clearer, but you're probably going to get some walkouts when the conference begins, and you're going to get some walkaways before it begins. So, and are we going to get peace? No, probably not. Not. I think this war has got a few years to run still, to be honest.
A very pessimistic view there, Mary. Is that your view on these negotiations, that they are, you know, that we saw during the Lebanese war that rattled on for a decade, you know, that there were often kind of gatherings of people, they never kind of managed to pull off peace until really everybody was exhausted by the whole thing. And we don't seem to be at that point because, to be honest, the Assad regime has had a few advances, even in recent days.
I think that's true, but I'm probably of a slightly sunnier disposition than Roger. I think the fact that the talks have got so close to starting is quite a miracle when you look at where we were this time last year, which was actually nowhere. And the fact is there have been two sessions in Vienna, and around the table have been both the Saudis and the Iranians. And, I mean, as you point out, they have now broken off diplomatic relations, and the suggestion is they may be there in a sort of low-key, low-rank capacity. But even if they are there, I think that each of them senses an interest in being there, or rather the risk of not being there, that something might be decided without them. So I think that the envoy, Stefan de Mistura from the UN, he's actually acted quite sensibly in saying, okay, let's forget about the squabbling. We are going to gather on Friday, and let's see who shows up. Because in a way, that prevents a whole load of people from holding the actual starting date to ransom. So I actually think the prospect may be a slightly better than Roger does.
Roger, is part of the problem that there's no one here who has the ultimate upper hand, not even one or two parties that do. You know, that all you would have to get, you know, the Turks, the Syrians, you know, the Americans, the Kurds, many of the rebel groups, the Iranians, the Russians, all invested in this process. And at the moment, they really don't have the same end goal in sight.
Yes, I think that's true. And I think that there's more to be gained. This is why one has to be sceptical about these. I don't think this is a 30 years war, by the way. I don't think we're in year six of a 30 years war. So I don't think it's going to be as complex to solve as all that. In the end, it will just have to be some kind of power sharing arrangement between Alawites and Sunnis within Syria that is guaranteed by outside powers, if you reduce it to its absolute reductionist minimum. But the fact is, this war has not exhausted itself. There's still things to be won, and you can see the next battle is for northern Syria, which is this Azaz corridor, which runs a narrow strip of land which runs from southern Turkey towards Aleppo, and everyone's gearing up for a big punch up. You know, there's the Syrian government and the Iranian units with some Russian air power. There's some Kurds with Russian air power. There's ISIS, the Islamic State. And then there's the rebels who are holding it at the moment. And that's just one strategic knot. And until these things are resolved on the ground, no one's going to actually make any kind of concessions whatsoever in peace talks. There's still ground to be won.
So is the problem partly, you know, that, you know, of course, everybody in the West hopes that, you know, the bombing is targeting ISIS. But as long as the regime can make some small advances, really, they're not that, you know, pushed to kind of come to a deal, are they? Because they probably feel they've got a little bit of momentum on their side now.
No, and I think that's what the Russians are telling them. They're saying, wait, you know, you'll become stronger. You will get stronger. And there's no point of entering peace talks at a situation when you're only, when you're a little bit under par, you know, you've got to hold as much territory as you can. And that's what's happening.
Mary?
I'm not sure that Russia is quite so much sort of hedging its bets and putting itself behind Assad and saying, you know, just hang on in there because you'll strengthen as the days go by. I'm not sure that's true at all, because I think in the last month or so, we've seen two very strong hints from the Russians that they are prepared to sacrifice Assad. First of all, there was Putin's interview with the Bild-Zeitung in Germany, where he didn't confirm or deny that Assad might be offered exile in Russia. And then just the last weekend, we had a report that looked to me to be very deliberately leaked by the Russians to the effect that they had offered Assad the prospect of leaving power in talks somewhere around the end of the year, and that Assad has refused. Now, it seems to me that both of those were warning shots across Assad's bows, and they say that Russia's support is not by any means unconditional.
But do you think also, Mary, that I'm on the sunnier side of the equation, and for you, Roger, as well, that in the end, you know, Russia has things to lose as well by the prolonging of this fight? You know, we've seen, you know, everything from the, you know, the downing of an aircraft packed with Russian civilians in Sinai. One, it becomes a bit of a target that while this with this continues, and, you know, it is becoming a bit of a conduit for some of the migration that is coming up, you know, out of Europe, because out of Syria, because is being blocked slowly bit by bit through Turkey and Greece a little bit. You know, they could find themselves, and they could also find themselves, you know, battling on their home front all sorts of turbulence if they don't begin to kind of shut down the situation in Syria a bit quicker.
Is that to the sunny side or the shady side?
I mean, I would say from the sunny side, yes, that Russia has a lot to lose. I mean, it has a lot to lose militarily if it can't actually hold the line, because it wants to keep its ships in the Mediterranean, its base on the Mediterranean, and what it's now got, an air base in Syria. So it wants to keep those military objects. But also, it is just as terrified, if not more terrified, of the prospect of more Russians, i.e. Chechens and Transcaucasians, going to fight in the Syria war, going to fight for ISIS. And even more so, just as the West is, it's scared of what happens when those jihadis return, if and when they return to Russia. So I think Russia does have an investment in trying to settle this.
Sorry, if I can just put it in
the shaky side, yes.
The shaky side. Of course, I mean, Russia is trying to make itself, or Putin in particular, is trying to make himself indispensable in global affairs. And as long as the war continues, and as long as Russia plays a strong role in it, a strong military role in it, then that's going to be the case. And meanwhile, no one's talking about Ukraine at all.
Well, we're going to stay in Russia now, where the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, has been looking back over the past year in his annual, very long press conference. He commented on many issues straining the relationship between Russia and the West. He said it was high time for the West to drop its policy of containing Russia. Lavrov said Russia could sue the British government too for slander over comments made in the wake of the inquiry into the death of Alexander Litvinenko. Mary, a bit of a subject for you here. Do we think that they would actually dare go to court over these comments?
I doubt it. I mean, I wouldn't actually exclude the fact that if they did go to court, they might have a case, but I doubt it's a case they would win in the British courts. And I doubt very much that they'd want to do this. I think this is really a gesture for the domestic audience to say, look, we've noticed this. We're not necessarily going to sit by and let it go. And that's really where it'll stay.
And the notion of containing Russia, do you think this is really a question about Crimea, or he's looking elsewhere he's literally talking about land becoming back in part of Russia, or is he talking militarily, economically, you know, the West has kind of ganged up on Russia?
I think when he sort of, at least as I read it, when he sort of spelt that out, there were two things that he singled out. One of them was the expansion of NATO to Russia's borders, which of course Russia has disliked for a very long time. And the other thing, which was very interesting to me, in some ways more interesting, what's called Star Wars or Son of Star Wars, and refers partly to the U.S. unilateral abrogation of the ABM treaty, which really offended Russia. I think on both those counts, Russia looks back to Cold War times and sees containment as a concept which it relates to those years and says shouldn't apply now to post-Soviet Russia. But also it says that those same things that it was afraid of 20 years ago, expansion of NATO and the ABM Treaty, abrogation and Star Wars, that it is still scared of those, and that leaves room at least for some sort of negotiation and manoeuvring on both sides. I think it's a signal, and it's an interesting signal.
Roger, your take on this speech?
Well, I think it was a classic example of Lavrovian passive aggression, really. I mean, he sort of hits out at us by saying, "You're hitting us." I think the containment was about those old things, about NATO enlargement, but it was also in anticipation of what the British might do. The British still haven't really acted. The British government hasn't really acted following the Litvinenko judgment. And there's quite a fear that there'll be a kind of Magnitsky-style act passed in the British Parliament, which they would also see as a kind of containment. That's to say, anything that basically cuts Russian contacts with the Western world is defined as containment, really, in this sense. So any travel ban, asset confiscation, any naming of Putin cronies, any expulsion of Russian diplomats, all these things which could theoretically be on the table, although, as I say, the British government's not exactly rushing towards that goal, but anyway, could be defined as containment, as just things that fit into that worldview that we're ganging up against them. But and of course, it's not just passive aggression, it's also diversion. It's also diverting the gaze from the actual issues raised by the report made by Robert Owen on the background to the Litvinenko murder.
Just tell me, this idea of containment, Russia's not doing itself any favours in recent days. First of all, we've had the comments about Litvinenko. It's been said that the hand of Mr. Putin was involved. And then we've had these reports in the last day or so about the gifts and the money amassed by Mr. Putin. The idea that he was kind of given the odd yacht here, and that he's got access to endless palaces, and that his personal wealth seems to be extraordinary. At a time when the oil price is collapsing in Russia, the notion of corruption, we think of him as completely untouchable, but looking ahead, do you think that he really is that untouchable?
You mean financially?
I mean, in the sense of what Russians will respond to him and his kind of position in the world. Because, it's very easy for, Lavrov to go out there and say, we want this and you're not doing this. But actually, if at home people begin to say, hold on, our quality of life is going down, there is very little money left of, social policies, things are not quite good. And hold on, we weren't listening before, but now we seem to see all these reports about a massive wealth amassed by all of these cronies. It looks like a kind of a mafia government, what's been described in the past couple of days.
Well, that's easy for him to deal with, in the sense that he can get rid of, as he got rid of one recently, Yakunin, he can get rid of any cronies who look liable.
Well, it's easy for him to deal with because the reports were so poorly substantiated. Mm. I mean, I watched the Panorama programme on BBC last night, and I was completely shocked, frankly. I mean, I was not shocked because anybody was accusing Putin of anything. I was shocked by the flimsiness of the evidence, by the propagandistic tone, and by the fact that nobody who actually dissented from any of those views was given a platform. The latest, most authoritative biography of Putin, which comes from the Brookings Institution by Fiona Hill and Cliff Gaddy, that has a chapter where they basically go through those allegations, those same old allegations, and say that they have found nothing to substantiate them. And my view, for what it's worth, is that is most likely to be true, because I don't think money is what motivates Putin in the slightest. There are all sorts of other things, but not money. He can be accused of creating a climate where it's possible for other people to be corrupt, but I don't think you can finger Putin in that way.
Well, we can talk a long time about that. But Andrew also asked about vulnerability. And I think there is a vulnerability at the moment. You have parliamentary elections coming up, and United Russia Party, which is his party, is extremely wobbly. It's not doing well. And it's the one, and it's where you will see discontent with the government anyway. Putin will stand above that and will try to ride through it. And then in 2018 comes the presidential election. We have to see where that leads. But in a sort of crazy way, I do agree with Mary that actually it's, first of all, these reports are very difficult to substantiate. I know because we did a long investigation too, and which went through all three generations of libel lawyers before it got into the paper. And I must say, there wasn't really all that much. There are people around him that have grown rich because of their association with him, that's for sure. And they have influence over him, and this is for sure too. And there was a moment when he was interested in money. And if you dig far enough back, you will find that he was interested in money, but then he stopped being interested in money. And money doesn't protect him anymore. And I think Mary's right. It's not what he's interested in. And actually, I'm not so sure that the Russian people are all that interested either. I think they quite like the idea of him being a bit flash. If he were, I think they'd be all right with that. This sense of indignation about the rich being rich is not as acute as you think it might be. It's not even as acute as it is here in the West.
Well, we're going to take a short break now, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about Iranian visits to Italy and also Denmark's policy on refugees.
We're raising the curtain on a brand new show here on Monocle 24, devoted to the best in cinema. Tune in every week to hear from filmmakers, critics, and luminaries of the genre as we shine a spotlight on everything from revivals and the restoration of vintage cuts to Hollywood's golden age and the role of the auteur.
I never think of architecture or cities or landscapes in cinema as merely being a kind of neutral backdrop to the action. They are the action themselves.
Hear feature-length interviews with the biggest names, roundtable discussions, special reports, and more as Monocle 24 delves into the rich history of the silver screen. The cinema show on Monocle 24, in association with Mubi, premiering Fridays at 20:00 London time, because life is too short for bad films.
And welcome back to Midori House. Still with me is Mary Jajewski and Roger Boys. We continue now with one of the latest turns in the migrant crisis in Europe. Just some hours ago, the Danish Parliament passed a package of measures to deter refugees from seeking asylum, including confiscating valuables to pay for their stay, something international human rights organisations had protested against. The measures were passed by an overwhelming majority. Proponents say that the policy brings migrants in line with jobless Danes, who must sell assets above a certain level to claim benefits. Critics compare the move to the confiscation of valuables from Jews during the Second World War. Mary, your take on this?
I mean, when you first heard these reports, it sounded almost impossible. I mean, just from the sheer public relations perspective, the idea that you were going to confiscate value, strip valuables from people who'd made these extraordinary journeys across continents, finally to fetch up in Denmark, this just sounded not just improbable, but heartless and totally wrong. When the Danes then came out and said, well, it just puts everybody on a par with our citizens, who claim benefits, they must sort of reduce their means and their possessions to a certain level. You can understand how that plays in Denmark, but I think there really has to be another way. I mean, how about, for instance, saying that if you arrive in Denmark with means above a certain amount, then you are expected, as it were, to spend your way down to qualify for state aid. But spending your way down might include, say, staying in a hotel or renting a flat instead of taking your state-offered refugee accommodation. I wouldn't see anything particularly wrong with that, but I think the approach that they've chosen is so crass that it just plays into the views of the other side. It's bound to provoke international opposition.
Roger, the funny thing about the Danes is, you know, they have this kind of global reputation as, you know, the kind of nice yogurt eating, tricycle riding kind of, you know, hippies. But in fact, they've got some rather tough policies always coming out of, you know, Copenhagen. You know, and they've got some form of this, you know, whether it's, you know, the Muslim cartoons, their antagonism sometimes of the Muslim community seems almost deliberate.
My mum's a Dane and she's tough. But it's Yes, it's complicated. I mean, to be honest, the Danes hate the Swedes more than they hate anybody else. And it's the Swedes really that have caused this by, through Danish eyes, that's the way it looks. They've done this German thing of inviting massive amount of Swedes and then a massive amount of Syrians and then basically closing the border, actually literally closing the bridge. The Oresund Bridge. And now, as a domino, Danes, which already has a right-wing government and already has, as you say, a slight history of tension with its Muslim minority, is having to step up and escalate. You could blame it all on the Germans, of course, but or anyway on some kind of domino effect that's resulted from the collapse in the Dublin regulations. And that's the way it is. Yes, I agree. But I don't think it's actually going to happen, this confiscation. I think that it's done... it's a piece of political theatre which is supposed to reassure ordinary Danes. If you look at Danish websites today, you'll see that they're full of people saying, yeah, you know, quite right too, you know, if Danes, you know, have to be earning below whatever it is, £800 a month before they get welfare benefits, well, then that's what the basis they should be on. We should all be treated equally. So this sense of equality is very strong in Denmark too. And then there's also this social democratic thing that happened in Scandinavia, this homogeneity of the welfare state there. There was something racist about it right from the beginning. There was a sense of we're all in this home together, we're going to share the wealth that we create, but with ourselves. And you open it up slightly to show that you're... generous to the outside world, but on the whole, it's a rather inward looking philosophy. So it's all those things together in one very badly mismanaged package.
So far as I understand, one of the other defences that Denmark has is that Switzerland does something pretty similar.
Switzerland's doing it, yeah.
But Switzerland seems to confiscate the goods or the money and put it away and, as it were, hold it hostage for the event that the migrant or the refugee decides to leave Switzerland, in which case it all gets paid back.
Uh-huh. With interest.
Both have kind of odd echoes. We're going to have to move on. We have one final story in just a couple of minutes. President Rouhani of Iran is in Italy at the moment, and someone somewhere had the bright idea of covering up naked sculptures so that he wouldn't have to kind of let his eyes fall on the naked naked form of ladies kind of in the Capitoline Museum. Is this kind of sensible? Is it, you know, is this just pandering? Is this wise? Is this diplomacy? What do you think, Mary?
I think it is pandering, but it's also quite wise, because this is this is one of the first trips abroad by Rouhani, and I think you really don't want anything to intervene that might actually make things more difficult than they already are. So I think it's probably quite a wise thing to do. I seem to remember that this is actually a postponed visit, and when the first visit was mooted, there was a whole problem about a banquet being cancelled because the Italians couldn't imagine having a banquet without alcohol.
Well, I think the French, when he's...
Oh, yes, the French
have said the same.
There's no lunch
because, you know, we're not going to have lunch without any wine.
Yes. So, I think there've been sort of measures taken on both sides, and for a first time around, this is probably wise.
But I can't imagine lunch without wine either, so I kind of agree with the French there. Roger, do you think this is a sensible move? You haven't got long to tell me, by the way.
No,
like
in PR terms,
seconds.
It's very sensible for Rouhani not to be photographed next to a marble penis in the Vatican.
We are going to leave the marble penis and everything else there, because that's the end of the show. But Mary Jasewski and Roger Boyce, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and by Eugenia Derez. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Carlotta Bello
show, we're bringing you lots of music from Monocle's playlist. Then at 1900 hours, it's Section D with Josh Fennett. And at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily with Andrew Muller. We'll be bringing you up to date with all of those stories and many, many more. This show, well, it'll be back at the same time tomorrow, of course, which is 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck, and thank you very much for listening.